Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Buddhahood Without Meditation, Part 3.
Okay. I'd like to start off this evening with any questions or experiences you had with the tools that I presented to you yesterday. Yes.
Well, I really appreciated your adding the dimension of the primary practice of opening your heart to the experience, because it adds a whole other dimension to the experience. So I really feel like that's an enhancement for me.
Okay.
So I appreciate that.
Anybody else? Anne? It's one of the disadvantages sitting right in front of me. People learn after a while.
Well, I spent quite a bit of time outdoors, and I was very comfortable, and I was watching clouds, and at a certain point, sleepiness arose, and the instruction was to do nothing. So I did nothing, and I was sort of experiencing the sleepiness, and I'm not sure what happened, but it felt like I went to the edge. I didn't fall asleep, and then suddenly it just shifted, and I kept doing nothing for a while longer. That was very interesting.
Good. Anybody else? Carolyn?
I don't have anything else.
Yeah, it looked as if you were avoiding saying something. It was my imagination, obviously.
Is this something you would like me to say?
No.
I found the day went better for me after I had an explicit instruction for me. Doing nothing was
be very interesting. Doing nothing is enhanced by an explicit instruction. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate?
Yes, part of doing nothing in the way that you've been talking about it, I think, is what experience is that?
Mm-hmm.
And doing nothing is about learning to rest.
Yes.
And your explicit instruction was what rests. So it brought together two aspects of things for me.
I see. That's where we're going to go this evening.
You did want me to say so.
I think this is called interdependence.
I didn't hear a word, but since we're going to go there this evening, can you give me a little synopsis so that I can hear?
And if you can't hear, just wave suitably or sit up front. Or
sometimes you can't even hear up front.
Yes, I know. I speak very softly.
No.
Well, she's in the
back. I also didn't hear.
Yeah, but she studied with me for a long time. It's infectious.
No, I'm talking about other people in the room. It's not just you.
Yes, I know. It's infectious. They've learned very badly from me. That was a joke. I happen to find out jokes these days. Okay, Carolyn, synopsis. In the primary practice, it ends with what experience is this? And doing nothing involves implicitly a kind of resting. I posed Carolyn the question, what rests? And so this brought the two things together for her. Okay.
I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, that was the synopsis though.
Okay.
Understanding is a whole other matter.
Okay.
Any other experiences or questions coming out of the talks? Yes, Eli.
I had one coming out of our interview where I phrased or described my difficulty with doing nothing was stability or staying in that place. And you had suggested that, I try to identify what it was that was causing what I referred to as instability. And within about 20 minutes of having met, I sat and tried to do nothing. And what I found was I became aware that it was almost a totally different experience. Like the difference between high definition TV and the early 35 millimeter. And then I concluded that the difference was the degree of attention. I had thought of that I wasn't trying hard enough or concentrating enough, but that isn't doing nothing. But the attention seems to be from a different dimension, but made a lot of difference for me.
You're quite right. The level of attention makes a very big difference. When one has cultivated a good capacity and attention, then a lot of things that would normally distract simply arise and or come and go. One's whole experience is more vivid because there's a higher level of attention. And because things just come and go, one actually has the experience of doing nothing. Whereas if you're distracted, you keep feeling like you're coming back and working at something and so forth and so forth. This is why I put some emphasis on capacity last night. I want to go there and expand on that a little bit today. Hopefully I didn't lose my notes.
Your attention goes out. The higher the attention, you get more of nothing.
Yes, the more attention, the more nothing you get. Sounds like a good deal to you.
I might not have enough nothing.
You can never have enough nothing. What's that song from Porky and Bess?
I got plenty of nothing.
Okay. First, with respect to Guru Yoga. I find one of the better ways of regarding the guru I think I mentioned this yesterday, it is how you experience awakened mind or awake mind. In this way of looking at things, the guru is your own mind. It is your own mind telling you how to be awake. So it's very, very different from an idealized figure, a God substitute, or what have you. Because one has an interest in being awake, it is natural, and quite natural, to hold this aspect of one's experience with a degree of reverence, appreciation, and it is also somewhat important that you feel some confidence or trust or faith in it. In the Tibetan tradition, three kinds of faith are described. The usual order is progressing from clear, open appreciation to rational faith. I think this must have been because it's a medieval institution. But in terms of Guru Yoga, I feel that the opposite order is the more appropriate one. Something makes sense to us, and that both answers and arouses our curiosity. It feels right, it makes sense in some way. And so there's faith which comes from a rational appreciation. That's a kind of confidence. On the basis of that, a longing arises. A longing to dispel the sense of separation from the world, a longing to know how things are, a longing to know what we are. It can take many, many different forms. For some, it is simply a longing to come home. That longing becomes an impetus for practice in itself. Not only does it become an impetus for practice, it becomes a basis of trust. As we find a person or people who seem to know something about this, and that actually deepens our love. Maybe provides some requitement, which in turn allows us to feel that longing more deeply. And that longing is a very, very powerful emotion. We see it described very explicitly and very eloquently in the far-reaching cry to the Guru. Here's Kongtul writing about all the different ways that he screws up in his practice. And I hate my enemies, cling to friends, and be fuddled about what to do or not do. When I practice, I am dull, sluggish, and sleepy. When I don't practice, my senses are clear and sharp. Can anybody relate to this? Okay. Samsara has no purpose, I give it one. To get food and clothing, I let go of solid intentions. Though I have the essentials, I always need more. I fool myself with insubstantial and illusory experiences. Anybody can relate to this one? I'm just picking a few at random here. My faults are huge like mountains, but I conceal them within me. Others' faults are tiny like sesame seeds, but I publicly condemn them. Though I have no abilities, I brag about how good I am. I call myself a practitioner, but I don't really practice. Does this strike any chords? So, one of the things I want to do at this point is differentiate this from notions of sin, particularly original sin, and concepts, because these are part of our cultural heritage in Western culture, really. And the difference here isn't that I have done something fundamentally wrong, which is jeopardized my relationship with the whole universe and all existence. And thus I am in danger of being excommunicated from the universe. That's basically how original sin plays, isn't it, Claudia? Yeah. And it may not be intended that way, but that's how it plays inside. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's a very acute look and very honest look at what all of us do all of the time. One of the great heroes in Tibetan tradition is a individual called Geshe Ben. I'm not sure when he lived, but he took practice quite seriously, and he took mind training teachings very seriously. And there are numerous stories, but I'll just give you two as examples. One day he was seated in the monastery, and in the monasteries the meals were served by cooks coming in with very large ladles, and they would ladle the soup or whatever it was into your bowl. That was it. And as he was sitting there, he noted that he was hoping that when it came to his turn, that the cook would dip deep into the soup so that he'd get the thick stuff at the bottom rather than the thin gruel at the top. And as soon as he noted that, he went, yelled out in the middle of the prayers, "Thief! Thief!" And of course, everybody jumped up and looking around, "Where's the thief?" And he went, "Me!" I was hoping to get more than other people with the thicker stuff at the bottom. On another occasion, he was in solitary retreat, and he received a note saying that his patron who was supporting him in the retreat was going to come and visit. So he looked at his shrine, and he went, "It's a mess. There's cobwebs all over it, and he hadn't done anything, been dusty, etc." So he got up and he polished all his bowls and refilled all the offerings and made all the images nice and spruced everything up and swept all the dust, cleared all the cobwebs away, sat down, looked up and went, "You hypocrite." Reached into his fireplace, pulled out a bunch of ashes and threw them over the shrine. Now, it's very, very easy for us in this culture to criticize ourselves and be very harshly critical And part of this is because of the obsession with purity that is again a part of Western, and actually I would say particularly American heritage. One has to remember that the motivating emotion associated with purity is anger. The quest for purity is the cause for an awful lot of wars, internal and external. So when we hear stories like this, a lot of people think, oh, I should be really hard on myself. But that's really not the intention. It's just like, okay, I'm doing this now. And as soon as there's that moment of recognition, there's now a possibility of choice. Whereas before there wasn't any choice. And so you choose. And Geshe then goes, you hypocrite, throw stuff. I mean, which is a huge no-no in Tibetan culture. You never throw ashes on the shrine. He came in for a little criticism about that. But everybody agreed that the motivation was sound. That so many people, if they fail to be perfect, are harshly critical of themselves. And this is actually a form of internal abuse, really. So when we're talking about this longing, and you notice all your shortcomings, watch very carefully for that critical attitude to come out. You see what you're not doing. Okay. You're not capable yet. When I was studying with Rinpoche in India, he would always say, if you can do this, good, and if you can't do this, then pray to be able to do it. And I always thought it was, when I first heard it, I thought it was, he's just saying that to make us feel good so we don't have to. Feel bad about not being able to do it, because really we should be able to do it. But as my own practice matured and as I came to appreciate how intractable certain obstacles and reactive patterns can be, I began to see the wisdom in it. That is, okay, so you can't do it. Well, don't make your inability to do X into an enemy. Use it as a basis for generating a positive aspiration and see what comes of that. And that's very, very important. So when we talk about faith as longing, be very careful about being critical of yourself in the process. See what you do as clearly as possible. But let your heart open to that yearning and see what that does for your practice. Most people I've worked with, I find that it allows them to, because if they open to that yearning in themselves, then they're much more capable of opening to whatever that arises in experience. As you engage this kind of opening, the third kind of faith arises quite naturally. And that is just a lucid or clear appreciation, which is not really rational. And it's even a little bit beyond emotional. It has an element of clear or lucid knowing in it. This is the this aspect of faith, or this kind of faith, is the connection between faith and insight. One of the Shampa masters, the fifth one of the seven jewels, is a person called Chergompa, lived in the 12th century. And I came across a short piece that Kongtrul had quoted from him in some supplementary text we were studying in the retreat. And he said that there are three doors in the Dharma. There's the door of impermanence, the door of compassion, and the door of devotion. Now, for those of you who want to dig around in this, you'll find that those correspond to the three marks and the three gates of liberation and all of that. But I'm not going to go there this evening. I just want to focus on the last one, devotion. Devotion is an emotion, and it is, like the four immeasurables, an emotion that is not organized around a sense of self. That's what distinguishes the four immeasurables and emotions such as devotion from the reactive emotions such as anger, pride, jealousy, greed, and so forth. They aren't organized around a sense of self. All of them are a form of opening or engaging the world in an open way. And I like to call these the higher emotions, or if I'm feeling impish, I like to call them the impersonal emotions, because they aren't organized around a sense of self. So, in the practice of devotion, there is this emotional opening to whoever you're regarding as your guru, whether it's a historical figure or a live figure or what. And in other traditions, it's the Dhamma, and in the Theravada, it's the Dharma. Every tradition has its repository of devotion or faith, and it varies. But as there's the emotional opening, this third kind of faith begins to arise. And it is just clear, open, open heart and open mind. And it moves very naturally because of the high level of emotional energy in it. It moves very naturally into non-thought and clarity. And for many people, they also experience often experience bliss associated with it. And this is how it bridges into insight, because with any of three of those, the bliss, clarity, and non-thought, you have a high level of attention, and so that begins to power the scene. So this is why in the Kagyu tradition particularly, and generally in the Tibetan tradition, devotion is regarded as a very, very important, as probably the most crucial factor in spiritual practice, because it opened one to this kind of faith, which in turn just naturally opened to insight and clear knowing. An extreme example of this is Gutsangpa, who is Drupa Kagyu patriarchs. But he installed himself on an island and just practiced guru yoga, nothing else, very, very intensively. And by the end of a month, found that he had round the clock, stable, lucid attention. So that's a fairly extreme example, but that was his experience. I think there's a little bit of talent in that, too.
I'm struggling with the concept of faith and devotion, in that historically my perception of those two concepts is faith in something or devotion to something.
Yeah.
So it felt like an object out there, so I'm a little...
Thank you, that's a good question. The way I define faith, and I would hold this definition up in any tradition, not just Buddhism. You can plunk me down in a Christian church and I'll argue for the same definition. the willingness to open to whatever arises. And if you look at what happens, if somebody says they have faith in God or faith in Allah, if you look at that functionally, from a functional point of view, that's exactly what it enables them to do. Because they have faith, they're willing to open to whatever arises. So the devotion, yes, is usually directed as an object because of its emotional nature. And that's why it's either an object or a symbol. But it's something. It can be a person or a symbol, but it is something. But that's where it starts. As one moves into a deeper relationship with it, one finds that, in a certain sense, that quality in which you feel the devotion for, you begin to find it. Everything becomes an expression of that. And so now you just have that opening everywhere. You follow?
Everything meaning all experience.
Everything you experience. In Christian terms, you see everything as the manifestation of God. In Buddhist terms, you see everything as the manifestation of your guru. What's the difference? Or in Yidam practice, you see everything as a manifestation of Yidam. That's what you're training to do in Yidam practice. Does this imply that there is a God, there is a Yidam, or that these things exist? No. One of the things that's really important to remember here is that Buddhism is completely epistemological. It's not ontological at all. That is to say, it's not positing the actual existence of anything. In fact, I was just reading in Buddhahood Without Meditation. You know, if you think that Buddhas exist, you're on the wrong track. Buddha is a way of experiencing things. And that's very, very important to keep in mind, too. Okay? So, I wanted to mention those three kinds of faith in connection with Guru Yoga, because it's important and it often allows a way in. One can view those three kinds of faith as hierarchical. I'm not sure that they actually are. They very definitely reinforce each other. The main thing is to let yourself feel that faith, however it arises for you. And that's what transforms emotional energy into attention. And uncovers awareness so that you can just be present. So any questions on that before I go on? Dan?
I just don't see the connection between faith and opening to ways. I know lots of Christians living on a fundamentalist part of the world have lots of faith. And I don't see a lot of opening to ways.
Do they have a lot of faith, or do they have very strong beliefs?
I am asking.
Yeah, I think it's important. Belief, I define as the attempt to interpret what's out there to conform to what's in here. Now, I haven't done a lot of work with fundamentalists, but the little bit I have, I found both are present. That in some it's absolutely belief. And if you don't fit into certain things like that, then there's zero communication. At the same time, I remember a fundamentalist minister who was on the AIDS Interfaith Council, which I was also on for a while in LA, and she was just amazing. Because her practice allowed her to open to whatever was there. And I just really admired her, because she would come to meetings and around the table there would be all these extremely liberal and Jewish rabbis and Episcopalian priests and things like that. And she would just be right there focusing exactly on and telling everybody what really needed to happen if they wanted to enlist the support of fundamentalist people in the work dealing with AIDS. This is the late 80s when it was the epidemic was at its height. So I would very much like to get in touch with her, because I just thought she was marvelous. She would stand up in these crowds, like 200 people, and she knew that everybody was coming from a completely different perspective, and she was just there. And I did not get the sense that it was the rigidity of belief at all. Okay. Body.
Well, in Catholic theology, faith is trusting in what is unknowable.
That sounds awfully similar to my definition.
And love is opening.
Okay.
To whatever arises.
There's a problem here?
No. I think that it's a semantic issue sometimes.
Sure.
In terms of comparison.
Yeah, but trusting in what is unknowable. That's pretty close to opening to whatever arises. Yeah?
I don't mean to split hairs.
Yes, you do. Absolutely, you mean to split hairs. Go ahead and split them.
The way that Christine Awareness was written about, described in the text we're using, is from the other text, the beautiful prayers, to me that sounds like an ontological.
Sounds like what?
Sounds like an ontological
principle. Yeah, I'm working on that one.
I hope so.
Thank you for reminding me, actually, because I need to go back and reread some things from that perspective. We are so used to ontological thinking that we fall into it very naturally. But I remember Rinpoche was in the first tour, two tours of North America, which I translated for him. Again and again, he would be asked, "Does Chen Reizi exist?"
I remember those days.
Yeah. No. Do Yidams exist? Etc. And he would always say yes. But then you had to pay very close attention to why he thought they existed. Because people had experienced them. And that is an epistemological one. Things are just because anything that's experienced is.
Page 139, there's a refutation of the chapter before it, which sounds epistemological. Can you repeat that a little bit more? On page 139, there's a refutation of the chapter before it, which sounds epistemological. Do you understand that?
Can you define those two terms, please?
Yep. One sec. I'm not going to take time to study that right now. Okay. Ontology is the branch of philosophy that deals with the nature of being. Do things exist, and how do they exist, and so forth. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy that deals with how do we know things, how do we experience things. And time and time again, people get tripped up on this, because Western philosophy, particularly Christian philosophy, has focused on ontology because it wants to prove the existence of God. God exists, and that's the big debate. You know, and Buddhism, for whatever reason, for a very good reason, decided that this was a complete rat's nest. The Nagarjuna and the around probably 100 BC or somewhere around there showed that any categorical statement about experience was inherently self-contradictory, thus putting an end to any ontological discussion, which is why all other philosophies find Buddhism so very irritating. I remember when we did a retreat with Rinpoche in 1986 at Big Bear in California, we had to share the facilities with a Korean Christian group for the first weekend. And when we were cleaning up afterwards, we found a mimeograph sheet saying "Witnessing Buddhism." And it had the Four Noble Truths and a couple of other things. And then underneath, scrawled in pencil, was "Never get into an argument with a Buddhist. You will lose." Because what happens is that Buddhism moves it onto epistemological grounds and then just wipes out anything. So, and this is what people study for years in monasteries to do.
Well, I would just like to say I used to be a Presbyterian, and the way I came to understand the word God actually meant truth way back in the old biblical days.
Yeah.
But it had become converted into a being, some being above who was omnipotent and so on. But that actually, when I came to understand that, then I saw no difference between
And I think there's a lot in that. I have a Catholic priest friend who attributes the possibility of atheism to Martin Luther, because, you know, do you believe in God? God is a person. Now, if God is a person, then you have the option of whether you believe him or not. So, there were these changes. Okay, so that's, I just wanted to open up those three faiths to give you a little more to work with in the Guru Yoga.
Next, name those again.
Just yes, there's faith, which arises from a rational appreciation, a rational understanding. There's faith, which arises from longing. I wonder if we should unplug that, because it'll work for both now. We'll find out. Oh yes, it's driving the mic as well, so the thunder's getting closer now. And then there's faith, which is a lucid, non-intellectual, non-conceptual appreciation. No, the pad.
The pad, right. The writing pad.
Okay, the second thing I want to talk about is extending the opening practice. Hopefully the storm will blow over and we will have clear skies tomorrow. No? What's the forecast?
Rain, thunder, rain, thunder, rain. That's for the next week.
In that order.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It'll get warmer toward the end.
Apparently it's his fault.
Oh.
Apparently it is.
That's Martha's mom calling.
Long time ago, I came to the point of view that it was just much easier to regard everything as my fault. It solves so many arguments.
Well, instead of the instruction, regard everything as a dream, the instruction is regard everything as Ken's fault.
Let's drive all blame into one, you see. The way I practice this is I drive all blame and it's me, and the way you practice this is that you drive all blame into me. You don't have any arguments about anything. Okay, sky gazing. I have greater faith. Is there a hurricane in the Gulf or something?
No. Right.
Well, if the sky does clear by some fluke, bucking the weather odds and all that, a very good practice is to just look into the sky, into the clear sky, and that's all you do, is you just sit there and look at it. And you can do this sitting up, or you can do this in one of the chairs on the deck, which lean back a little bit, or you can do this lying down on the ground. Now, it's a very, very powerful practice. First, on the practical side, given the intensity of the light here, it's probably a good idea to wear sunglasses. And definitely put sunblock on your face, otherwise you'll come back something like a lobster, because the ultraviolet's very strong at this altitude. Don't do this facing the sun, of course, because that's bad for your eyes. The way this works is that there are three skies. First sky is the sky that you're looking into. Now, when you look into the sky, you literally don't see anything. You have this blue in front of you, but there's nothing in it. And occasionally a bird or a plane goes by, but that's inconsequential. So there is nothing to focus on. Now, when you do this, you may notice various phenomena associated with your eyes. That is, until the rods and cones settle down in the retina, you'll see different shades of blue and little wrinkles and sometimes ripples moving through, etc., etc. That can go on for quite a while. And you also may see little circles, which are simply fluid on the cornea, right over the iris and pupil. That's just stuff. But as you look into this, you'll find it extremely difficult to hold thought. Thoughts may arise, but because of the openness of the sky and the intensity of the light, really, that's coming in, it's very, very difficult to hold thought. Some people just check out and go to sleep, so you may want to start doing this just in small steps to accustom yourself. It's also actually, once you get used to it, quite difficult to go to sleep, because you're very awake when you do this. Uh, you may also find, notice because the sky heightens your attention, you may become aware of much more subtle body sensations and the relationship between body sensations and thought than you were used to before, or that you were able to before. As your mind begins to rest in looking at the sky, it rests in a somewhat different way because you're looking, but there really is nothing to look at. Because there is nothing to look at, there is no, the sense of subject tends to diminish. And you find yourself experiencing a non-conceptual mind fairly easily. Now, this may not be in the first, second, or third session of sky gazing. It does, it matures. But how it matures will vary from individual to individual. That non-conceptual mind is the resting mind. It's the second sky. And as you become aware of it, you look into it as you look into the sky, or the first sky, the external sky. So now you're looking into both skies. Now, because awareness is now looking at nothing, all concept falls away, and you find yourself experiencing non-conceptual direct awareness. And Dzogchen terminology, Rigpa. And that's the third sky, the mystical sky. So you have the outer sky, the inner sky, and the mystical sky. Secret sky, if you want the usual translation. So sky gazing is a very direct way of bringing that out. And so we'll see if the weather cooperates.
Can you repeat the three skies?
There's the outer sky, which is the quotation marks physical sky. I hesitate to say that because there's nothing there. The inner sky is the mind resting, free from concept. But because it's resting free from concept, even though it's resting free from concept, it's still the conceptual mind because it gives rise to concept as soon as it moves. And it's the resting mind. And then the secret or the mystical sky is knowing in which all concept has fallen away. Or it's dropped out of the conceptual framework, whichever way you want to put it. And once you have the experience of looking at the inner sky, you can actually do this without looking at the sky. And just let your mind grow quiet and look at that. Any questions on that?
It's a real basic one on the first one. You said the it's called sky with no objects in it. So when you say clear sky, you're talking about a cloudless sky.
Yeah, ideally it's a cloudless sky. There were caves in Tibet set up so that when you sat in a cave, you only saw sky. There was no other reference point. You just sat at the opening of the cave. They were angled so that you couldn't see the ground in the valley or anything like that. They're specially set up for this. Relatively easy to build a platform in your backyard if you have clear skies. Any other questions on that? Okay, so that's topic number two. What time of night do we have?
8 o'clock.
Yeah. 8 o'clock, okay. Okay. Well, I'll leave that one till tomorrow. Okay. So.
Can I ask a question about the sky and the moon?
Of course. But speak up so Carolyn can hear it.
I'll try. In Sky Community, you said knowing arises in which all concepts have fallen away. Or another way to say it is that the knowing is outside the realm of concept.
Has dropped. Dropped.
Okay. And then that the second sky concepts return with any movement in mind.
Yeah, it's the resting mind. It's like the eighth consciousness.
And
it's experienced as clear, empty, but it's static. It's not like repo, which is clear, empty, and dynamic.
That's what I want to ask about, because mind is going to move even there.
Yes, but when the resting eighth consciousness, when there's any movement at all, then that movement is either experienced as a sense of self or a sense of other. That is, it arises in the seventh consciousness, which is the sense of self, or it arises in one of the six consciousnesses, which are associated with the six senses.
So we would say the songs leaves that basic ground.
Pardon?
It leaves the. It
leaves Kunshi.
Yeah.
Well, you have to distinguish between Kunshi and Kunshi Nambarshepa. Kunshi, the all ground or the basis of everything, this was introduced by Taranatha, basically. It's a fairly late introduction, and all the Galupas raged at him because they thought he was talking about the basis of everything, consciousness. So he just wrote a short paragraph saying, you guys have no idea what I'm talking about, so I'm not even going to argue with him. But the basis of everything, consciousness, is the mind completely at rest. That it hasn't, it's not free from the operation of duality. There isn't any duality experienced in it, but any movement is immediately experienced as duality. And if you go back to, see, all the answers are in here, I keep telling you this. Page 27. In the middle of 27, you have I, ever-present good, and the ground. Without genesis or conditioning, I am ground, natural awareness, what is. Internal and external distortions do not touch me. The stupor of mindlessness does not conceal me. Projections do not contaminate me, etc., etc., etc. That's basis of everything. Okay? Over the page. First, the fourth stanza. First, for confused being, ground awareness does not arise. That blankness in which there is no idea of anything is the genesis of confusion and ignorance. Suddenly, from that unconsciousness, a terrified and unclear knowing stirs. From that I, then other, the enemy arise. Okay? Carolyn, back to you.
You answered the question.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, I don't know how to even ask the question. Are there words that can explain how to look so that the dynamic aspect of whatever that is? I mean, I've asked you this question since the beginning.
Since the very real beginning. We've been doing this for lifetimes, Carol.
I'm afraid that might be true. See you next time, I'm afraid. Unless you're gone,
come on. Is there a way of looking? Continue.
Is there a way of looking that helps go from that stifled, empty, what? Stifled, empty kind of no experience into dynamic.
Ah.
No experience. Did you hear that, Carol? I did. Thank you.
Dave and Rinpoche explained to me once. You look at mind. Whether you do this through sky gazing or just looking at mind makes no difference. That when you look deeply, the mind becomes quiet and you experience the eighth consciousness. And you're looking. And you experience that as empty and clear. Now, there are many, many records in the books and in the sutras how people mistake the eighth consciousness for enlightenment, for awakening. And he said, you look at this, and you just keep looking at it, and like an ice cube melting into water. And you come to know how things are. So, there isn't a magic way of looking. This is not a matter of know-how, it is a matter of capacity.
I couldn't hear you.
It is not a matter of know-how. Once you know how to look at mind, you have all the know-how you need. It is a matter of capacity. It is the level of attention that you're able to bring, which is why there is so much emphasis at this stage in developing capacity. Rangjung Dorji was not allowed to do any insight practice until he practiced shamatha for 3 years. Capacity. You know, that's why one does things like Tummo, etc. It's all about building capacity.
What's Tummo?
The internal heat. Okay, so what I want to focus on now is is actually continuing straight on from Carolyn's question, is learning how to look. Now, and we're going to work on this today and tomorrow, maybe a third day if it's necessary. In Dzogchen parlance, this is about the view. And there are many approaches to it. I'm going to apply, work out two or three. So, as I suggested yesterday, breathe out and just rest wherever the out-breath leads you. Don't hold your breath out, that's not what I'm talking about. When you breathe out, the out-breath will leave you in a certain way. Just rest there. Let the in-breath happen by itself and the breathing continue. Just rest in however the out-breath leaves you. Then ask the question, what am I? You will feel a shift, just rest in the shift. Look around the room. Do it again. Breathe out. Rest wherever the out-breath leaves you. Ask, what am I? And rest in the shift. Relax, look around the room, move your body. And do it again. Breathe out, rest wherever the out-breath leaves you. What am I? Rest in the shift. Okay. Relax. What was your experience here? Lisa?
I experienced a heightened perception.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else?
Well, I was actually doing this earlier today where
I've always asked the question, who am I? And I've heard you say before that you know, it's really, what am I? And I could never quite connect with that, the what am I. But today I could connect with the what am I. And the what am I is such a different question than who am I. And doing this practice now is like, when I say what am I, it's like, oh yeah, it's like, I'm part of that substance of whatever it is. It felt like I could be part of that as opposed to who am I, which for me already is I and other.
Okay, that's good. However, as soon as you form the idea of I'm part of the substance or whatever, you're in the thinking mind. Mm-hmm. What do you experience before that?
Joy.
What else?
I experience being on the edge of something.
Okay, so that's where you rest. Okay, anybody else?
Very nervous.
Very nervous?
Yeah.
Say a bit more.
Like, oh shit.
Sounds like being on the edge of something. Would that be right?
That's all there is to it.
Okay. Anybody else? Everybody else experienced nothing whatsoever.
It's a little like a blank, bright blankness.
Okay.
And it shifted, but it didn't. I didn't notice any. There was a shift, but I can't describe it.
So you experienced a shift, and beyond that, you can't describe it.
Right.
Okay. Follow.
Just nothing. Not
even a ship. When you asked, what am I? What happened? What did you experience?
Just blank.
Okay. No answers? Would you describe that blankness as dull or clear?
Dull.
Ah. Okay. What experiences the dullness?
Well, just even.
No.
What experiences
the dullness? Don't think. What do you experience right now?
Unhappy.
But it's a little different, isn't it? Now there's
like
just
a question mark.
A question mark. Can you rest in that question mark?
Yeah.
Good. Do that. Anybody else? Do you have something to say, Carolyn?
I don't know.
I'm going to pick on Franca next if you send me comments.
It's not nearly as much fun.
We'll see.
The out breath takes me to a place where there is the beginning of the world as dream. That's just there at the end of the out breath. So, what am I? It gets much more vividly insubstantial.
Okay.
That's what happens in the areas.
Can you imagine resting there and doing nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I did it 3 times for however long that was. So I can imagine. I don't have to imagine it, I remember it.
Okay.
The first part is opening with the shift. The second part.
Speak up, sorry.
The first part is an opening, the shift, there's an opening. The second, with the question, is this intensity. I don't know how to explain.
Okay.
Just, it's.
All right. So, that inexpressible intensity is where you rest. It's not so hard, is it?
Why?
Pardon?
We'll give it a go.
Good.
There's also a sense with that question, a knowing quality that what I am is not what I think. This kind of blame.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go a little bit further. Go back there now. Breathe out. Rest wherever the out-breath leaves you. Ask, what am I? Rest in the shift. Are you your body? Are you a name? Are you the agent of your life? Are you the perceiver? What are you? Okay, relax. Move your body. What sayest thou, Carla?
Until the last question, there would be additional tension in my body, and then it would relax, and the ease would come back. The last question, I could never get to the ease. Are you the one who's doing your life?
Are you?
No, it's all arising together. There is no here, there is no me.
Ah, good.
Good?
That's Daya, narrative therapy.
Along with narrative memory and other things I cherished.
You're welcome. Small point, but maybe useful. Anybody else? Dan.
You have to back up, you know, you have to back up to describe, you understand? Totality.
Totality.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that?
Famous quote from our teacher.
Pardon?
Kempisho's famous quote.
How about your own? How about your own words?
I don't have any.
No, you don't get to stay. Go there.
Mm.
You're on the spot now. You know, if you say anything, I'll hit you. If you don't say anything, I'll hit you. What you got to say?
Please hit me.
You just want to get out of the misery, that's all. Well, you just have to be selfish here. I'll come back to you.
Do I have a choice?
No. It's actually quite important. For a lot of different reasons. And yes, we have famous lines from the perfection of wisdom, inexpressible, inconceivable, unimaginable, etc. But it's actually quite important to learn to speak from that experience. So, go ahead. I can give you a hint if you wish. Pardon? Let the experience speak. Forget about you speaking.
Experience can't speak.
Right into your conceptual mind. You just exited right there. No, I didn't trick you. It's a way. But that's what happens. We have certain fixed ideas. You stay in that experience, you let them all go. The experience actually can and does speak all the time. But we have our preconceived ideas. They flash up and take us out very, very quickly.
No, what actually arose in trying to think about describing it is some anxiety starts to come up.
Exactly. That's right.
Some anxiety.
Okay. Now, open to the experience of that anxiety.
That's fair.
Yeah. Go right into it and through it. Not with your head.
No. Well, there's no going through.
Okay, then speak from it. Right there.
More anxiety.
Okay, that's the edge of your practice.
Learning how to describe it?
No, experiencing that anxiety. No. This was useful because it put you in touch with it.
Mm.
But that's the edge of your practice. Follow?
No.
Okay. Anybody else? No.
Very heavy with emotions. Before this, I was heavy with emotions. In every stage that it took us there, I felt like there's like a balloon that flies up, and then my emotion, and I pull it back again.
Okay.
Every time it goes up, and but that it went up and down.
What experiences the emotions? can't see or can't say?
I can't see. I can't see.
You can't see. What are you looking at? So you can't see what experiences the emotions. Can you rest in that not seeing? What happens when you rest in that not seeing?
That can't be light for that moment.
Okay. So you take that moment and then you come back to it again and again. As soon as thought arises, relax, let it all go. Mm-hmm. Then come back. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm just thinking here that non-thought can all be experienced other than through sky gazing.
Non-thought.
I'm sorry. Non-conception.
Can be experienced.
Can be experienced. Cannot be experienced other than.
Oh no! It can be experienced in many ways.
Yeah.
All.
Okay.
Yeah. All of them. All of the ways in which non-thought is going to arise are, in one way or another, going to involve looking at nothing. Okay. So, whether we look at the sky, we look at what we are, we look at what experiences, doesn't make any difference. But we learn to look at nothing. No.
With those questions, the first being, are you your body?
A name.
A name.
Perceiver.
Each,
agent of your life.
Right. Each, what I noticed was there was an effort to identify with that, and then a no.
Yes.
It was like the effort made it unreal in some way, or mm-hmm. not believable.
Now, I could have made the list a little bit longer, but these are the principal points. So, here you have the direct experience. You're not a name, you're not your body, you're not the perceiver. A little disturbing, that one. And you're not the agent of your life. I mean, rating of 1 to 10, how disturbing is that? 14. Okay. These are.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yes.
Before we were involved in not doing
it. Right.
And now we're looking at.
I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. Okay, let me take care of Larry, and I'm going to come back to that. So, you're not the agent of your life. How does this sit with you?
At this moment, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there's some emotional material connected with that, right?
On reflection, but right now it's
okay. So, this is a way of refining what in Dzogchen is called the view. This is a way of refining what in Dzogchen is called the view or the outlook.
Refining.
Refining. This is what I'm doing.
You're saying to kind of disabuse oneself of any identification.
To look and know through your own experience that you're not this, you're not this, you're not this, you're not this. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming back to Eugene's question. when you know you're not a name. And you're sitting and somebody calls your name in your thoughts. Who are they calling?
When we're thinking of somebody calling our name.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just like, well.
You ever start that? Are people going, Ken?
No, I'm just, your name comes up in your thoughts. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm talking about. When you know you're not your body, and you're sitting doing nothing, what is the body? Gene?
You're asking me what is the body?
What is the body? When you're sitting doing nothing, what is the body?
Feels like an appendage.
Yeah, that's in the right direction. It's a set of sensations.
So it's yes and no.
I don't follow.
You have a body, obviously. Right?
Okay.
But it's not the totality of who you are. I mean, people can totally identify with the body.
That's right.
That's quite possible.
Yeah, we have a few of those in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell you a therapy story about that, by the way. So, yes, there is a body. Is that who you ultimately are? No.
Well, we're going a bit beyond that, then.
How you know it is through sensation.
No. All you know is sensation.
Mm-hmm. That's your only reference.
Yes. The body is a construction from sensation.
Right.
And it's actually quite different.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
There is no body, there is only sensation.
Right.
Follow?
Anything beyond that's a construct.
Anything beyond that's a construct, exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Are you the perceiver? So anytime you're doing nothing and you think you're looking at something, no? Are you the agent of your life? This is very important. Because how many of you have any hang-ups with productivity?
Efficiency and...
All of these have to do with being an agent in one's life, right?
Again, yes and no.
Back to construction. Things happen. We string together a story. What, Calvin?
Not so much anymore.
The story is a construction. So the purpose of the view is to make it more possible for you to rest and do nothing. Now, what I was doing this evening was pointing these things out so you had some experience of them. But for some of you, that experience may be sufficient, so you can just rest. And when those kinds of thoughts or considerations or pulls or tugs, they just come and go. For others of you, you may find it useful to duplicate what we did this evening together, so that you go through in your own experience till you know in your own experience that the body is sensation, that there is no agent of our life, etc. In this book, they go through a very long analytical process. Right? Am I my head? No. Am I my left arm? No. Am I my right arm? No. Am I my torso? No. Am I my heart? No. Am I the mouth? No. Am I my nose? No. And just on and on and on.
And if you mash them all up and dry them out into a powder, and then add water and squish them together again, they ask that question too.
No.
But those things only talk about the physical body. They don't talk about consciousness. That's the problem I have with that section.
Am I consciousness?
I am conscious.
Yes, you may be conscious, but are you consciousness? You took a quote right out of Arrow to the Heart. Thank you.
So it's distinguishing between noun and verb. I mean, we're not necessarily these things, but we do experience. We do experience perceiving.
What experiences?
Well,
now, just like that is how you practice. Just looking like that.
Puzzle.
But you're just looking. What experiences? Now, when you were looking that way, were you doing anything?
Well, I was searching a bit.
Just rest in the looking. When you do that, are you doing anything?
Resting is doing something.
Okay, so let that go too.
So just being.
Yes. How is that? So try that. Carol.
I have a question. Looking versus things just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a question, is it? I have to give it a verb. Well, can you comment on it? Because I think there's a difference.
What's the difference between zero and infinity?
Nothing and everything?
What's the difference?
The symbol.
Go a little further. What's the difference between becoming nothing and becoming everything?
I think has the same thing.
You tell me.
See, I would say that infinity is in one. I would say the difference is one.
But I'm not asking you, I'm asking her. For you, I have other questions.
Well, if I...
No, don't think.
Well, I was just going to say, if I just go back to the difference in the experience of look when I look versus when I'm thinking specifically, say, in terms of the primary practice.
Yeah.
So... I did the primary practice yesterday in a way where I was more passive and just things were just coming in, and then I've often done, mostly done the primary practice where I actively I'm looking at the edges of the field, and so there's a different quality. I don't know how it relates to zero and infinity, but
so what's the difference between looking and open?
When I look, I feel like I'm actively looking into everything.
Okay.
Possibly everything.
Okay.
But I don't know what that is.
Okay, and opening?
And opening, it just feels like everything just comes in.
Okay.
It does have a different quality.
Two together. Right there. What's that? Okay. Thank you. Okay, what time is it?
It's 8:47.
We're all working. Everybody clear about their practice? Doesn't it though?
So,
like you're doing nothing, right? Yeah.
It's not very real, is it? I mean.
You aren't one of these people who feels that doing something is a virtue.
I suppose. It just feels so immaterial and so what?
Empty.
Useless.
Useless, yes. Meaningless.
You're beginning to get it. Yeah. You're beginning to run into what prevents you from just being. You say, immaterial, useless, empty. I'm not doing anything. Right? Yeah, that's right. Let's take a 5-minute break.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.